and welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damien Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had a life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, the Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, the icon. You may know him from the band Generation X, but you probably know him as Billy Idol is on the show today. And my gosh, this is a fun conversation. More on that in 1 second. But if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutofpunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham, and he will get the message to me. Thank you, Tristan, very much for all the hard work you do on this show. You can find me on Instagram at LeftForDamien. There is a Facebook page, an Instagram page, a TikTok page, and a YouTube page, all for this podcast. All those can be found at Turned Out of Punk on those platforms, and there are videos and edits and stuff that get thrown up on those things. Did I mention TikTok? I think I said TikTok. And you can check those things out on those places if you are inclined. The best way to support this show is by telling all your friends about it, letting them all know that you enjoy this podcast and that you think they might enjoy it too. I also play in a band. We are called Fucked Up. You can find out more information over at fuckedup.cc. We are going to be playing at Pooza Fest in Montreal in a couple weeks, and that lineup is stacked. So come hang out and enjoy some steamies, and we'll have a good time. All right, on to today's show. As I said off the top, someone that I've always wanted to talk to, someone I was legit starstruck by when they came on this podcast, Billy Idol. I'm very excited to have this conversation with him. He's someone who I grew up as a kid of the 80s. Like, growing up, Billy Idol, to me, is like one of the most pervasive kind of images, and his music was some of my earliest music memories. And then on top of that, Generation X, which, you know, anyone who loves punk knows are one of the greatest bands of all time. So there's a lot to get to in this episode in the amount of time that I had. I got to give a huge thank you to Joe Cohen, who busted his butt along with Tristan to make this episode happen. And it took a while to happen. And my gosh, it was worth it. I'm stoked on it. Hopefully you are stoked on it too. Billy, of course, has got a fantastic, he's never put out a bad record, but he's got a great new record called Dream Into It, which is dropping on April 25th. You can check out the first single, which features Avril Lavigne from Napanee, Ontario. So right down the road from me. 77 is the name of the song, which details what else? Punk rock. So it's apropos that he's on this podcast talking about all this stuff. He will be going on tour with Joan Jett, who's also featured on the record, coming up. And my wife and my aunt, like, we tickets, there's a bunch of people in my family going to the show. I unfortunately have to stay home and babysit, but I wish I was going to the show. It's going to be an amazing time. So hopefully you get a chance to check out some of these dates with these two icons. Like, there's very few people that are bigger in terms of punk rock, kind of coming out of punk rock, than these two. This is a fantastic new record Billy has done, and it's his first one in 11 years. It features also Allison from Discount as well, so it's a punk rock affair through and through. Lots of other people are involved in this thing. It's like an amazing lineup of musicians and people from different bands and stuff. Anyway, I'm not going to ramble on too much more. You want to hear the episode. So you can click those links and check out this album when it drops, and check out the new single, 77, and check out this amazing tour. And then you can right now sit back, relax, and enjoy Billy Idol on Turned Out a Punk. Billy, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yes, I'm glad I could do it.
Well, I'm very excited to get to talk to you, because not only are you an icon for everything you've done, but I think from doing the show, I've come to realize that Generation X, particularly in America, had like a massive influence on punk and later on into hardcore. And I feel like because of your iconic status solo, it kind of gets a little overlooked. So I'm excited to dive into all that with you today. But I got to start this off the way they all start off, which is, Billy, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across it?
Well, I suppose it was, you know, the Velvet Underground, Iggy, the Stooges. Of course, I would have heard about the kind of the punk rock question mark and Mysterons, and you know, with 96 Tears and stuff like there was a punk music in the early 60s, the Seeds and everywhere. There's stuff that's on Nuggets, that I can't think of his name right now, but the chap who was at Patti Smith's group, he did those records, Nuggets, and they were early 60s punk, so it could be from that, even from can't think what his name is.
Lenny K.
Lenny K, yeah, Lenny K put those Nuggets albums, so it could even be, there was an early 60s punk that before the Velvet Underground and everybody. So it could even be from that. But yeah, the people who really put it on the map, though, would be the Velvet Underground and the Stooges, Iggy.
Well, it's interesting because in researching for this, it hit me. You're the original punk rock kids. Like the Bromley contingent, as you kind of get taken up as being called, are the people that are really like the foundational kids for punk rock. And it's when I'm like listening to your book, the audiobook version of your book, and you're kind of talking about all these different bands that kind of get taken up as being quote unquote proto punk. I'm like, of course, like you guys were the kids building this thing and like the foundation of this thing and really at ground zero for something that became a global revolution. Like, and I know what you're saying, it goes back to the 60s, but I think you guys are the titular first punk kids.
Yeah, we were just watching what was going on at CBGB's, really, or the American Max's initially, Max's, and Lou, with the Velvet Underground, Lou Reed's sort of Velvet version, I suppose, and then Bowie going there and producing Iggy, the Stooges doing Raw Power. We're watching all that, and then CBGB's, and then we just really wanted a scene like CBGB's in London. That was our initial thing, I think, because you could see the CBGB scene was just a tiny little scene. It wasn't exploding into America, the rest of America, just purely in New York. And but we were reading all about it, so we wanted a scene like that in London. And then my friends realized that the Sex Pistols were going, and we started to go to the shows that they were putting on at the Oxford Street, and the 100 Club, those May gigs when they started to do that residency. And basically, there was just us there and the Pistols playing. And I suppose there was John Lydon's mates, the Johns, there. I mean, but it was virtually no one there. I mean, it was just us, really. And maybe there's a few other people. I mean, there somewhere there would have been Tony James and Mick Jones and that, but I don't remember seeing them. I didn't know who they were, so maybe they were all at those. But there was hardly anybody at the Pistols because no one knew about it. It was like no one knew about them really, at the 100 Club. But my friends had seen them at Bromley Tech. That's where they'd seen them. They played a gig at Bromley Tech, so we knew about them. We started to follow them. And then you could kind of see there were other people like us, kind of similar age, and they were improving every week. The more they played, as you watched them week to week, they were improving. And then they started to go from covers to writing their own songs and putting them in the set. And the first one was pretty vacant. And then the next week, it was anarchy. And it was like, wow, these guys are now writing songs for our generation, and not just writing song killer songs. They were killer, and you sort of like saw that, wow, with this scene. Yeah, so that it was easy to sort of go, wow, here's the door opening for us, that because we'd I'd always wanted to be in music and stuff, but the sort of level of musicianship you were seeing in the sort of prog rock days was very high, so you couldn't imagine how's something going to let us kind of be able to come from a very sort of basic level of musical knowledge and then be able to improve just by playing, and there was the Pistol showing you, don't worry about how good you are, just get up there and do it and then improve over time. And in fact, this is what our generation wanted. We wanted a bunch of people who weren't so accomplished so we could grow together, I think, in some ways.
Well, you bring up your generation, and there's a part in the book where you talk about being in Chelsea and writing, I think, Youth, 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 and realizing you can't be in a band with Gene October, who's 30, and be writing music for this new generation. So there is a real generational divide that kind of seems
Yeah,
to hit.
because when you're 20 years old, someone of 30 actually seems quite dramatically older than you. And it, also, too, it was me and Tony were writing the songs, really. And then Gene October said that he wanted us to write a song, Mad Dog, called Mad Dog. And we were just going, how does that fit with Chelsea? Because at the time, Chelsea was a kind of a retro 60s kind of mod, retro 60s kind of. And me and Tony wanted to be in a punk rock group, really. So we were starting to write songs which would be for Generation X. And then, yeah, Gene October wanted us to write this Mad Dog song. We were just going, how does Mad Dog fit in with Chelsea? We just couldn't see it, So there was a little bit of that, And then I think, just right from the start, I was nearly going to be in Susie and the Banshees at one point. Play guitar in Susie and the Banshees, and I realized, well, they really need a real good. I was okay on the guitar, but it was I learned the guitar for me to sing to. I didn't really think of myself as being a lead guitarist, so I just knew as well Susie was going to be the singer, and I wanted to be the singer. So Tony kind of knew, even when we were in Chelsea, we knew really I wanted to be the singer. And we were really starting to write songs, really, for me to be the singer, really. So we were, yeah, and soon we left Chelsea, and by November 76, we were gigging as Generation X.
Yeah, like they brought up that, I think, was it called Flowers of Romance already by that point, or was it already Susie and the Banshees? Because I heard it was
Well, they
Flowers.
did, Susie and Sid Vicious and Steve Severin played as the Flowers of Romance. At the Hundred Club, the punks festival that where the Damned, Sex Pistols, and Susie and the Banshees played, but they were called the Flowers of Romance that night.
And
Romance.
you bring up the fact that, well, you bring up the fact that you didn't think you were talented enough on guitar, but they had Sid Vicious right on bass at that point, who was,
Think he played the drums.
oh, he played drums, sorry. Yeah, that's right. He played the
Yeah.
drums on that point. So I guess,
And I was going to play guitar, but then I joined Chelsea, so they got the chap who ended up being Adam and the Ants, guitarist. I can't think of anybody's name today. I'm sorry.
no worries, because I'm digging into your memory banks with all this stuff. I really do feel, because I think it's important, like this stuff. And I think your perspective on this cultural shift that happens is so key, because you're not only helping to shape it, but you're also there to kind of bear witness to it. And then through the Roxy Club, helping to kind of give it a home where these bands could play.
Yeah, there was a bit of violence at a Pistols gig at the Nashville or something, and then something happened at the Marquee. I don't know quite what happened, but there was a bit of an unofficial ban from the club owners of London. They sort of didn't wasn't official. There was an unofficial. So we started the Roxy to give ourselves a place to play and a place to rehearse, and then it became ground zero for punk. And on the opening night, it was us, Generation X, playing with the Clash, and then the Heartbreakers were headlining. And we had 1,000 people in this little place that really only held 250 people. It was really like a little dance club, but we had 1,000 people. Once the other club owners heard about that, this unofficial ban ended. But still, we started this club, the Roxy, that gave the rest of the punk bands a place to start out. If they couldn't start out in these other clubs, they could start out at the Roxy. So it became ground zero for punk in London, UK.
In the book, when you talk about violence, you specifically mention Screwdriver showing up and playing and sort of bringing a violent element into the punk scene. And they obviously become one of the most horrendous bands of all time. But there's sort of this early period that people kind of give, I guess, a pass to, because it's always said that they weren't political then. But were they already bringing kind of a violent element into the scene back then, in sort of the Chiswick era before the National Front kind of period?
At first, it wasn't really. I mean, there was a little bit of violence that was, yeah, Sid Vicious, I think, through was trying to beat up Whispering Bob, the guy on the Gold Grey Whistle Test. And I think he threw a glass at him or something. It was very minor. And it was more to do with our generation sort of reacting to the people who'd come before in the 70s, in the 60s and 70s, a kind of very collegiate. They're more kind of collegiate, so it's more that. I mean, and I think there was a little bit of the violence that was at. It was just a fist fight or something at the Nashville where the Pistols had a bit of violence. Our scene up until this sort of Oi movement and that wasn't particularly violent. That's not what I remember. I mean. But over time, as you got the sort of pr the different pressure groups started to react to punk, then you started to get the sort of skinheads who really were right-wing fascists, hated the fact that we were kind of more, we were outsiders embracing other outsiders, like the sort of immigrants who'd come to England, who'd been allowed into England on the Empire passports. At the end of the Second World War, doing the jobs the British didn't want to do. They didn't want to work on the railways. They didn't want to work in construction. They always brought the Irish in to do that, and then they brought Jamaicans and Indians and everything came in on the Empire passport. And we were embracing that because we were kind of all about the outsiders in the world, and we're also into their music. We're into the reggae music coming from Jamaica and what it was saying. Because there was a the reggae music was the roots of reggae. They were going through a musical revolution, and that's what we were trying to do with punk, was bring about a music revolution. So we were very embracing of those people, and but the skinheads in particular, of course, there was a throughout the 70s there was a pushback against the immigrants who'd come to England. There just was there was this thing. Bashing. There was groups of white guys going around beating up, immigrants and stuff. And also the police were doing that. They were going around in groups of 20 with their nightsticks out, in vans, jumping out, ready to jump out. There was a suspicion law. If they sus had suspicion that you were doing anything, they could, stop you on the street and whatever, molest you or whatever. So we were very embracing of that, whereas the skinheads were hated us for embracing that. And then the Teddy Boys were a bit more they were into early rock and roll, didn't like the way we were wearing their clothes really. But also they hated the fact they were royalists really, and so they hated the fact the Pistols had sung "God Save the Queen." And there was a bunch of royalist people who were not Teddy Boys who were also fighting back against the punks, and then there'd be this war on a Saturday afternoon down the King's Road, where these pr movements would meet up and fight, and it was all kind of reflecting. England was going through a massive depression. America was going through one at the end of the Vietnam War, around 75, 76. You were going through one. Well, if you're going through, America's going through one. It's much worse than England, so. The whole of England was in a terrible uproar throughout the 70s. I mean, the unions were fighting whatever government was in. And then there was a lot of polarization of the way people felt. People were very polarized, rather like America today. It's not so different. England's a polyglot society. And funny enough, what happens in England usually happens in the States 20 or 30 years later. And that's kind of almost what we're seeing a little bit going on today.
Well, I'm in Toronto, Canada, actually. Actually, where
Oh, yeah.
there's a band here, a famous hardcore band, one of the key hardcore bands called Youth, Youth, Youth.
Ah.
To say that your impact was not limited to just America when I was talking about America earlier, I meant global. I think, and it's different how I find that Generation X is looked at in England versus in North America, where I think you guys were critiqued a lot heavier by the press, it seems, early on, and there was a lot more sort of resentment towards the band, outside of the fact that you had a massive fan base, I mean, but like in America, I think you guys were just so foundational to people's getting into this music. Like, there's just every podcast I
Yeah,
do,
people
it's
like
you guys
Henry
come.
Rollins really liked.
Absolutely.
He pushes our Generation X music and stuff. He really, on his when he had a radio show and stuff, he was always really promoting us. So, yeah, I mean, I came to America in 1978 to sort of do a promotional tour, a press tour for the first Generation X album, and then, yeah, the people were very were super. You know, the people I ran into who were punk people, so to speak, in the States, they really, really liked what was going on in England, and they liked what we were doing. They just did, and it was, yeah, it's just there's a little blowback against us in England just because I think because we had girls in the audience, really, we were because we were a fairly good-looking band, which wasn't the case of most punk rock groups, weren't. We actually weren't a bad looking band, and so in a little way we got a little bit of blowback about that. And maybe we weren't as political as the Clash or the Pistols. We were sort of singing more. We had a very teenage audience too, because we had a. I think I looked like I was 16. I didn't look like I was 20. I looked 16 or 17. So we sort of got a lot of the very young punks. And so maybe there's a lot of that sort of stuff. Also, we were on Top of the Pops and things like that because we'd been recorded by Phil Wayman, who'd produced the Sweet, because I like the Sweet's drum sound and that. And he hated us, by the way. But because of him, because his bands got on Top of the Pops, we were on Top of the Pops almost immediately. And that was probably another reason, maybe. You know, we were accepted by the mainstream a bit more, it seemed, maybe to some punk people. But there was a lot of competition between the groups in a way. You know, I mean, everyone was knocked out about all the different groups writing songs, but there was a little bit of a once all the record companies, once the Pistols went on the Grundy show and swore on there, and then it was the filth and the fury next day on all the English newspapers. Then every record company in England wanted a punk rock group, and then you've sort of felt there was you felt the competition a bit there. But in general, though, everybody was digging what everybody else was doing. I mean, we were, you know, like a song like Kiss Me Deadly impressed a lot of people, I think, because it was a really good song, you know, and it really did speak about two punks journeying through the London nightlife, which was dangerous. Yeah, at a certain point, it was dangerous in terms of you'd run into all these pressure groups fighting each other. And that's what it's kind of about. It's about the young people, yeah, going through a London night to see their favorite band or whatever.
I was playing that song in the car the other day, and my kids were in the car, and they were like, "What's this?" And they normally hate what I play in the car. So that song does have, like, it's so good. It's got, like, a timeless power to it. And I think,
Yeah, it's one of our best songs on that first album, you know.
you guys created an archetype, which is sort of like, and excuse the turn of phrase, but like the teen idol punk, where you look at Green Day, you look at Blink-182, you look, there's always going to be this sort of aspect to punk, which is sort of the understanding that this is what this is about, which is getting up on stage and bringing young people to this thing, and maybe not, maybe the older people won't get it, but there's going to be a whole whack of young people that certainly are influenced by it.
Yeah, I mean that's kind of we were sort of singing songs. Generation X, it was more about social problems or teen, you know, about we were young to I was a young 20, so I was only 20 in Generation X. So we were singing songs that, yeah, were a bit more about a social, not so much political, but social, you know, in terms of that Day by Day and songs like that, Kleenex and everything were more about social problems rather than political. And so maybe that we did have more of a teenage audience than some of the other punk rock groups. Well, we all had teenage audiences, really, but we got a lot of very young punks as well.
Yeah, and so I think it's the melodic quality to the records too that I think you kind of need as that gateway for younger bands. And that's something that's important to this day to kind of replenish these punk scenes as people get older and kind of move on. You need those younger bands or those bands that bring younger people, I should say, to this scene because they're going to become so key.
Yeah, it was just really, it was so exciting being involved in the punk scene in London. It was super exciting. I mean, it was really one of the most exciting periods of my life was those years in the mid 70s towards the 80s. So it was super exciting. It was just because you're watching this thing grow, like exponentially, really, and then start growing around the world, Start realizing, oh, it's not just in London, it's happening in Australia, it's happening in America, it's happening in Cleveland, it's happening in LA, it's happening in Chicago, it's happening in Washington, 100 Club, oh, one, yeah, Club 100 or whatever. Can't think about anything today. Oops. Yeah. But yeah, you start to know there's the Saints from Australia, you start to realize, then there was the Stinky Toys from France, you start realizing this thing is around the world. It's not just London, it's not just New York. So you kind of could feel that happening.
And you would have seen that right away because you're on that first France trip with the Sex Pistols. I think the Stinky Toys opened that show, right?
Well, we went, yes, we me and Steve Severin and Susie Sue and the two Michaels who were saying never mind the bollocks. That's who came up. The two Michaels, they worked on a barrow down the East End. They came with us and Simon Barker, and I drove us to watch this Pistols play at the Palais de Glace, I think it was. And it was kind of well because it was some end of the Second World War thing in France or something. And then Susie was wearing her night porter gear where she had the swastika on, and she was driving these left-wing French people crazy because they didn't get that it's a performance art kind of thing. They just thought she was, because they were practically communists. So they were thinking she was an anti-communist. And it was, she didn't really, they didn't realize it's part of punk performance art, But it was a great night, and the audience, though, were getting really upset that, as I say, Susie had the swastika on and stuff. So we sort of escaped across the stage. The Pistols had come up across the stage, and we went backstage and kind of escaped from the audience because they were getting really upset. They just didn't understand the sort of London fashion performance art aspect of punk, where we were reflecting back on the British society, what they were doing to us. By wearing these sort of political symbols, like Vivian Westwood would combine the swastika with communist symbols, Karl Marx, and it was all a bit of a fuck you to the sort of the conservative forces in England that we were sort of feeling that they were going fascist. So we were going to, oh, if you're going to go fascist, then we're going to reflect that back to you. It was a performance art aspect of the way we dressed and. That people don't get now. They just think, they don't get that aspect of the punk rock way of dressing was a kind of a reflection back on the powers that be. This is what you want us to be. You want us to be fascist. Oh, what about we'll dress like that, to frighten you. And it worked,
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here, reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance. Like your first home expansion or your first big lightning strike. There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company S.I. and its operating company 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
It's funny, like, I don't think they got it back then, because I've been watching all these old British sitcoms and sketch shows type thing, and they're parodying you guys on TV right away. Like by 77, there are TV shows making fun of punk, and it's wild how quickly it spread and became like a pop culture phenomena from this thing that you're saying it's like five or six people going down in a van to see the Sex Pistols.
It just really exploded once the Pistols went on that Grundy show, that 6 o'clock in the evening, and that lorry driver, truck driver, put his boot through the television. And like I say, on all the newspapers next day, the filth and the fury, every kid in England wanted to be either in a punk rock group or be a punk rocker. You know, next minute, when no one was wearing leather, everybody had a leather jacket, you know, because only the Ramones wore a leather jacket. Most kids in England were wearing denim, you know, and then suddenly the leather happened, you know, because of what. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, because of what the Pistols were. The punk was more about wearing leather. You know, we sort of brought that back, the leather look, you know.
But it's like you guys were, like you said, you guys were waiting for it. Like, you know, in the book, you talk about all these bands that, you know, are proto-punk bands that you guys were into. You're looking at the CBGB scene. You're kind of like waiting just for a band to do it. And there feels like there were, obviously, the Sex Pistols are such an incredible phenomenon, but they're like, London SS, there were a couple other bands kind of bubbling up around the same time, right?
Yeah, London SS, there were other people, yeah, but it was also, you know, everybody didn't know each other. You know, there was no networking yet. So, yeah, once I met Tony, I really found out, oh, there was Mick Jones and Tony were in the London SS. And it kind of is almost beginning of the Clash in a way, London SS, because I think Paul Simonon was almost in London SS or something. Brian James of the Damned was in London SS. So, you know, there was people, you know, starting to get together. And then Joe Strummer was in, he's in a pub rock group, you know.
The 101ers.
101ers, that's it, yeah. And so it was starting to happen. Pub rock was kind of what presaged punk in London, you know. And then we kind of blew that apart by starting punk, kind of ended pub rock in a way, you know, that became old-fashioned almost immediately. That was the other thing I think we were trying to do. I know with the look of punk, we were definitely trying to make the bands that had come before us look old-fashioned. That was the other thing. Take on this new look and make the people from the 60s and 70s look, even as the 70s is still going on, make them look old-fashioned. That was kind of
well, in the book,
you look like they're already past it, you know. And then we were playing shit like that too, you know.
Well, that's like a band you feel bad for is like Dr. Feelgood, who definitely have that
great,
incredible band, right? And have that energy, but they didn't have that look, I guess. And they weren't young, right? They were probably over 30.
Yeah, they were probably 30. Yeah, and. They were fantastic. That's who we were following on the pub rock circuit. We were following, you know, before the Pistols, we were following Dr. Feelgood and Kilburn and the High Roads. That's who we were kind of following on the pub rock circuit. And then, and Paul Young was in some band. I saw Paul Young in a band, that some R&B kind of band that he was in, you know, and on the pub rock circuit. And I guess Tom Robinson was going on the pub rock circuit. But punk went beyond that, and it blew that scene away, you know, really.
And there was like a bad
run. Stranglers were going somewhere as well. The Stranglers were going.
Well, yeah, you bring up the Stranglers. Like, there was a bad rub on the bands that were perceived to be from the pub rock scene. Like, Don Letts, when he was on the podcast, my co-host on that episode made the mistake of bringing up the Stranglers to Don Letts, and Don Letts got very agitated and was like, they weren't part of our thing. They were
it's just there was a little bit of that, what you call it, it was a little bit of snobbery, you know, who's in it and who's not, you know. And just because they had started a year or so earlier, you know, but really they were a great band, and I think that was a little bit of the problem. There was a little bit of snobbery going on, and but really, when you look at it, if all those groups were important to what was going to happen.
Well, I guess a label that kind of came from that pub rock scene and came over to the punk scene too, Chizik Records. Is it true they sponsored that first Generation X demo that you guys did?
We did bootleg our own demo and made out as if somebody had stolen our demo, four-track demo tape, and... it was us doing it. We I don't know, we'd read somewhere somebody else in the past had done that, you know. So we bootlegged ourselves and printed up a load of white labels. And then we got Steve Strange, a friend of mine, to go around, he's from Wales, to go around the record stores on a bicycle with some of our, making out like, I've got these discs, you know, like like it wasn't us. And then he took them to Rough Trade and a few other places, and it probably may have been through Chiswick. I don't really know 100% now. But they sold out really quickly, and then the record companies heard that. And, of course, once they think you can sell records, and they all wanted their own punk rock group anyway. So we were being offered ridiculous sums of money and stuff. It was crazy because it went from nothing to these huge deals and things, you know.
In the book, you talk about how important signing with Bill O'Coin as a manager was for you.
Yeah, for me, yeah, me personally, yeah, it ended up being super important, yeah. Because once Generation X was ending, I knew if I stayed in England, it's likely I'd end up just propping up a bar or something, you know, because things go through really fast in London. I mean, an album can be over in three weeks or a month. It can be over, you know, you put it out, it can be over. Whereas in the States, things are only just getting going after 2 months. They're not even, people are only just starting to realize there is a record, you know. Yeah, so I kind of knew if I stayed in England, you know, it's likely nothing will happen because people have already seen you. They feel like you're over. They've seen you. So maybe if I go somewhere else and start again somewhere else. And, of course, the place that was obvious to me was New York, because I just knew that because of CBGBs, because there's going to be other like-minded people who are into the same scene. And if I could go to America, maybe have some sort of success or find a new group and then bring that back to England, that would be the best thing to do. And that's what happened. And of course it worked in spades because, yeah, I came back to England with Rebel Yell, with Eyes Without a Face, with Flesh of Fantasy and Rebel, you know, all those songs that then just exploded in England. So it worked, me going somewhere else and then coming back to England with a bit of success really worked, because by the time I came back to England, we were number four in the charts with Eyes Without a Face, number six, the album was number six, Rebel Yell was number six. And we'd already had White Wedding on the first, and Hot in the City on the first Billy Idol solo album that had done well in the States. So by the time we're going back, and we'd already played in England in 82 at Heaven or whatever it was. So we'd already, yeah, I was able to bring what I, and with Steve Stevens, I was able to come back to England with this killer guitar player and show people you hadn't ended at all. In fact, you were revitalized and, you know, super carrying on what you'd started.
In the book, you talk about how it was through Chrysalis that he came in contact with the band, or you guys got in contact with him to become the manager, right?
Yeah, Tony James said to Chris Wright, what about the chap who manages Kiss? And Chris Wright said, well, actually, we know him. And we went, oh, really? And he said, yes, we know Bill O'Coin. We can get in touch with him. And then when we signed with Bill and everything, in the end, really, Bill really just wanted to manage me, I think. He, you know, started off managing Generation X, but he really just wanted to manage me. And he said to me as well, he said about him, he knew there was this 24-hour music cable channel that was on the horizon, you know. It wasn't called MTV yet, but he knew there was going to be this 24-hour a day cable channel, which I would be perfect for. And also, we'd already hooked up on the last Gen X album. We'd hooked up with Keith Olsey, because I'd said to Bill O'Coin, what we need is a producer that knows rock and roll, but also knows, the, for want of a better word, the disco world, the dance world. And then Bill, because Kiss were on Casablanca, he got hold of Giorgio Moroder. He didn't want to do it, but Keith Falsey, who was working with Giorgio, heard my tape and said to Giorgio, he wanted to produce people. Keith wanted to produce people, but he'd only done his own record, I think. He'd done Take Me to the Pilot, his own record. And so he said to Giorgio, can I do it, boss? And Giorgio said, yeah, if you want to do it. So he came to England and we did that Gen X album with him, which had Dancing With Myself on it. So I was coming to America with that sort of, once I got Steve Stevens in America, I hooked up with Keith Falsey and we started to work in America, kind of carrying on what we had started with that last Gen X album.
Well, because, like, are you familiar with a guy by the name of Bill Bartell?
Well, I know a Bill Bartell who runs but the Harley Davidson thing, but I don't
No,
think
this
I
would have been Bill Bartell. He was a kid from Los Angeles, and he was Bill O'Coin's friend. He was obsessed with Generation X.
Oh.
You were his favorite band. And he was the guy that got Bill O'Coin to first contact Chrysalis about managing you guys before you guys even, I guess, mentioned it. There's
Wow.
a new documentary that came out called The Secret Lives of Bill Bartell. Fantastic documentary. This isn't a plug for it, just this is super interesting to me. And in the documentary, Durwood's in it, and he talks about how he found this out way later, that it's actually Bill Bartell that was telling Bill O'Coin, you have to sign these guys. But then the ultimate irony is when the band's broken up, he blamed Bill O'Coin for breaking up the band and taking you away from his favorite band. So he always took it on the chin that he broke up Generation X, his favorite band.
Yeah, we were breaking up anyway, really. That's what was going on. You know, the other two guys had left before we did the Gen X album, and really, I don't think Tony wanted to go. Tony James, I don't think he wanted to go and live in America. Like, you know, like I didn't mind. You know, I'd already lived in America when I was a little kid, from 2 and a half till I was nearly six. I was 5 and a half, nearly six. So for me, it wasn't so daunting. Going to America, it was more like, well, I'd already lived there. So for me, a little bit, you know, it was easier for me to think about that. But I don't think Tony really wanted to leave England, you know, not permanently, sort of thing. Whereas I didn't mind. I was willing to do whatever it took, sort of thing. That's what I was.
I think you guys had to break up for music to progress too, because obviously,
Possibly.
Generation X has had this influence, but then you have this incredible seismic influence on pop culture. But even Durwood leaving, like, he does that Empire record that you bring up, and that Empire record did not sell very well. But one place it did show up was in DC, and people like Ian MacKaye and the guys from Minor Threat, they bought that Empire record, and that became the foundation for all their bands kind of in the Revolution Summer Going On era. And that influences a whole wave of other groups. So, like, I feel like Generation X breaking up, it's almost like the decaying of this band gives life to these massive cultural forces in two different worlds.
Wow. Well, he's great. He was a really great guitarist, Durwood. And I'm glad they did the Empire and everything. And because he's super talented. He's a really talented player. He has a natural melodic. He's got a natural gift that's pretty, that right from the first time I saw him, I knew this guy's great. And I still think that.
You also talk about playing with the Offs. And I think that is a band that people do not talk about enough. So it was really surprising to hear you mention them in the book, that you saw them and played with them on the first trip to America in 78.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, Johnny Too Bad. We did a reggae, but punk rock to Johnny Too Bad. We probably did something else. I can't remember what other songs we did. But at the Mabuhay Gardens, it was a transsexual night on a Tuesday night, I think, because a lot of the clubs that were putting on punk things were usually gay clubs. And then on a Tuesday night, we even did a tour. The White Wedding tour was like that. We were playing. A lot of these little clubs we were playing were gay clubs that on a Tuesday night they went punk, sort of thing.
Well, I feel like it definitely was a very accepting scene. And you talk about this in the book. And Jane County, the fact that one of the main proto-punk people is Jane County and her stuff that she was doing in New York. Like, I feel like this was a safe space for people to be here. And it's not till later, like you're saying, when other stuff starts infiltrating at National Front and these other horrific kind of influences that it becomes such a regressive scene.
Yeah, initially it was, yes, it was very embracing, people who didn't feel like they fit in, for whatever reason. It could be a gender thing, it could be a cross-dressing thing, or it just could be, you didn't feel like you, people would say today, you didn't feel like you're being seen. That's what we felt like. We felt like we were being told you don't have a chance of a future. There's no future for you. It was seriously what we were being told. And so we just banded together with the other like-minded outsiders, and they were coming from all sort of different areas, gender, politics, political politics, personal politics, and lots of reasons why, or maybe people wanted to be artists as well and weren't getting a chance. A lot of people picked up a camera and photographed the scene, and some other people who wanted to be a journalist started a fanzine because they're never going to write for you're not going to get a chance to write for a newspaper, so they just created their own. And that's kind of the do-it-yourself ethic of punk led to then a lot of people ending up doing those jobs for real. But they would become a photographer, or Adrian Thrills still writes for a major newspaper today.
Well, and it still becomes that place for people. Like you're saying, it's a place that says that anyone can do this, and you don't need the skill. Like, you can find the skill, you just need the passion. And like, from Vice magazine to you name, like, Bill Hader to Fred Armisen on Saturday Night Live, like, all these people came to punk and found their voice through this music scene. That, and I think that's why it's important that it was you guys and these sort of younger kids doing it. Like, you bought that CBGB scene, it's older too, and when they're doing it.
Yeah, they were, that's right. They were a little bit older than us. They were, television and people like that had been around for a while, kind of thing. And we were super young. Yeah, we were practically teenage. We were just out of being a teenager, basically.
And also, like, the fact that, you talk about in the book, and people make much legend of it, like, the fact that you didn't necessarily need to be skilled at this thing to do it at first, that's so important. You need to work
about it.
Yeah.
You could know only the modicum of stuff on a guitar or whatever it was, whatever musical ability. And it didn't matter that much, as long as what you did was cool, or you still had a good melody, or you still had a good song, even though you may not be very accomplished, you still were coming up with something that resonated with the audience that you're playing to.
In the book, you tell a story about being at a party at Peter Aykroyd's house, Dan Aykroyd's brother.
Yes, that was later on in America, yes.
Were you friends with Peter at all? Rest in peace, by the way.
Well, I met Dan Aykroyd and Bill Murray and people like that. They rode motorcycles and stuff. And then, so they used to kind of a grapevine, really. And I was actually living at the Chateau Marmont when John Belushi died there. I was living there that night that he died. So I even met Robin Williams that night at the, on the rocks above the Roxy in America, in LA. And I knew they were in that hotel that night. I knew Robert De Niro had been seen in the hotel. And then that night, John Belushi died. I was actually living in the Chateau Marmont, making the first Billy Idol record.
Wow, that's incredible. Because Peter Aykroyd played in a proto-punk band called Wheelchair from Toronto.
Oh, I see. So,
I've always been fascinated by his connection to it. But you brought up John Belushi. Were you into the hardcore stuff at all when you started seeing that show up in America? Because I know John was into that stuff and famously brought Fear on Saturday Night Live.
Well, yeah, the bands themselves, the hardcore bands themselves weren't violent, but the audience they attracted, they attracted a lot of people trying to smash up their shows. So they sort of almost self-destructed in a way. That started to happen in England as well when the kind of Oi! Scene happened, where it was a bit more skinhead. That's when a lot more violence started to happen. You know, the first wave of punk was over in England, basically, by 78. That first initial wave that had happened from 75 to 78 was starting to pass. And then you started to get these other movements, the Oi movement and that, a lot of skinheads. So, and then in America, it was more the hardcore scene kind of, yeah, it sort of attracted a lot of violence because they were, singing a lot more sort of agitated music. It was a lot harder music. But somehow or other, it sort of attracted this audience that ended up destroying the scene. It was kind of, and I watched, there was a documentary about it that I never really realized quite what was happening with what happened that hardcore got destroyed, you know, until I saw this documentary. And then I realized, right, the bands themselves weren't violent, but the audience they attracted for some reason was actually out to come there and destroy the gig, you know.
I think it's because of the sensationalist press coverage that was going on, and because of like everyone misinterpreting like what you guys were doing in the early days, like pogoing, and then pogoing became slamming because people were like, we got to take it up a notch.
Yeah, initially Sid Vicious started pogoing because he didn't like the fact the Bromley contingent, we didn't dance, kind of, we just stood and watched it. So he started it so he could jump all over us and push us around. But that's how it started. And but yeah, that's a little bit of a shame. That's what happened with hardcore, because a lot of the bands weren't violent themselves. It was just what they were singing. They were singing about things in a violent way because they were so committed. But then it led to, yeah, you're right. I think it got the newspapers or whatever exploded. That's what they kind of were doing in England. I mean, they were doing the same thing. They were trying to destroy the scene by saying it was a bunch of kids being violent, when it wasn't. It was a bunch of kids being artistic or searching for a way to express themselves, or searching for a way to be seen in a society that was saying, you don't count, you know, we don't care. You know, there's no money in the economy, and there's no money coming from young people. They say, so you don't count, you know, you're not being seen, you'd say today.
Yeah. You brought up Sid Vicious. Do you feel like, what do you feel about his legacy and the way he's kind of looked at? Because I think a lot of the sort of negative aspects that kind of showed up in America were people kind of worshiping Sid Vicious and taking up like the pogoing or just the self-destruction of it.
Well, it's sad, really, because Sid did become a bit of a victim of himself. And really, he was a nice guy, you know, really. He was, when you got to know him, he was actually a nice chap, really. But he just, he kind of took the image of being Sid Vicious like a little too seriously or something. And it led to his downfall. I mean, he didn't really, he didn't stand much of a chance, really. I mean, his mother, I think, was a junkie and stuff. So, and I don't think he hadn't really had a real father or anything. So I don't know, so many things kind of worked together. And then maybe the thing of ending up being Sid Vicious sort of just kind of like ended up destroying him in a way. It was sad because actually he probably could have. Actually, I said to Jonesy about him being the singer in the Pistols. He said, oh, I tried to work with him on My Way. It was a nightmare. It was a nightmare doing those few songs we did. You know, Something Else and My Way. It was a nightmare. He said it was terrible. So I couldn't think of him being the singer at all. It's a shame because that's what he should have been. Probably would have been better off being, because he actually could sing, you know.
You had that spotlight put on you. Like, that's the thing. You were so young as well, like to be kind of thrust in this. And you've been, had this attention put on you from such a young age. And it must be a lot to weather, especially when you're a kid and people are writing about you in the NME. By the time my band was getting written about in the NME, I was already 30. So I was already over it. But you were like a kid having to deal with this shit.
Yeah. Criticism wasn't so easy to take. I mean, nowadays, I don't care. You know, like the last album we did, Kings and Queens of the Underground, there's one magazine said it's my masterpiece, and another magazine I got 1 out of 10, you know, which is it, you know? That you can like you almost laugh, you know, whereas back then he got really upset, you know, if you, you know, with our second album, Generation, really got slagged off. And it wasn't that bad, really. It's just, I think people were looking for a whipping boy, you know, they were looking for the magazine's enemy and that were looking for a bit of a whipping boy. And then we were kind of like a bit of an easy target.
Yeah,
but, and I think in the audience, and we were fairly good looking compared to the other punk groups in England.
And I think so, history,
and we were, yeah, maybe people could see, yeah, I had the ability to go mainstream one day. It could have been that too, but yeah, it wasn't easy. Yeah, a lot of the attention. Yeah, because we were never expecting that. I mean, when we started Generation X, we were doing it purely for the hell of it, for the love of it, and we were thinking this is only going to last 6 months, maybe a year, maybe 2 years, and if that's all it that's all that happens, at least we'll have done what we cared about, you know.
Yeah, and I think history's proven you right on that second record. Like, that second record is beloved, and I think once again in America, where the press, I don't think, had as much sway or didn't have as much. Like, I think that record was beloved out of the gate by these young people.
Yeah. Yes, it was more in England. It just got a bit slagged off. And maybe a lot of the... We moved kind of quickly with the way we morphed from the first album into that second album, and maybe it caught people by surprise. Because it was a little bit like we were trying to move, take the Kiss Me Deadly thing and expand that.
Can you tell me about the In Concert with Timothy Leary that you did?
Yes, later on when I was doing Cyberpunk.
What was it like hanging out with Timothy Leary?
It's kind of fantastic, really. He was hanging out with people like Tool as well, the guys from Tool, and... there was other people as well, Mark Mothersbaugh, I think. And it was kind of cool because I kind of knew of him from the 60s and, of course, of John Lennon. He's in the Give Peace, he's on Give Peace a Chance and everything. He kind of knew a lot of his stuff, and it was kind of fun getting to know him. I enjoyed it.
Did you ever get to try his acid?
No, I did a lot of that, though, in the 60s. We did a lot of acid and stuff.
Well, I don't want to keep you all day because I could punish you forever, Billy. And anytime you want to come back on the show and talk about seeing pink fairies on LSD or Hawkwind or Cyberpunk or anything, you're always welcome.
I did see the MC5 in 1969. I think that was alongside the pink fairies. They were the other good group on this. It was Fun City. It was this festival down at Worthing. It was this tiny 2-day festival. It was mainly hippie bands, but in amongst all these hippie bands were Pink Fairies, of course, really great. But really killer was the MC5. And for me, it was like, this is the future. I'm seeing where it's going to go. And I think, you know, that was another band that really inspired us, was people like the MC5, you know.
Well, you talk about the MC5 show in the book, and I've been recommending the book nonstop to everyone that I've talked to, and I that goes without saying on this show. So, yeah, MC5 as well. Next time you want to come back on, we can go in song by song through the MC5 catalog.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you.
Hey, baseball fans, go yard with BetMGM, the sportsbook born in Vegas. Enjoy top odds on your favorite home run bets, fast and convenient ways to play same-game parlays, special boosts and tokens, and so much more. From the first pitch to the game-winning fireworks, there are more ways than ever to supercharge your excitement. Download the BetMGM app and get your piece of MLB action. BetMGM is an official partner of Major League Baseball. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER, available in the U.S. For New York, 8778. HOPE-NY. Or text HOPE-NY 467-369. For Arizona, 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. First bet offers for new customers only. All other promotions for existing customers. Subject to eligibility requirements. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.